Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Science Fiction. I'm Rob Wolf with the Gentrifiers Are Back edition. We start 2022 with a new novel that features, among its storylines, a phenomenon familiar to those of us who live in cities. That phenomenon is gentrification. But as one should expect from science fiction by an author as talented as my guest today, this novel describes gentrification with a twist. Yes, some things are familiar, like people today with higher incomes who move into neighborhoods and push out the old-timers with high rents and coffee boutiques. The gentrifiers in Tochi Onyebuchi's novel Goliath are coming into urban neighborhoods that have suffered from underinvestment and systemic racism. But unlike gentrifiers of today, who often leave behind comfortable suburban lives, the gentrifiers in Goliath are returning from comfortable lives on space stations, where those with means had originally fled to escape pollution and environmental degradation on Earth. Tochi Onyebuchi is the author of Riot Baby, the Beasts Made of Night series, the War Girl series, and the nonfiction book Skinfolk. He has degrees from Yale, NYU, Columbia Law School, and the Paris Institute of Political Studies, and he is on the line with me from his home in New Haven, Connecticut. It's great to have you back on the show.
Oh, it is such a pleasure to be back, always.
Since you were on last year, the book we talked about then, Riot Baby, has been a finalist for so many awards, Hugo, Nebula, Locus, to name a few, and it's earned plenty of awards, like the World Fantasy Award. So I just wanted to start off by saying congratulations.
Thank you. It still doesn't quite feel real to this day. Yeah, no, I've been so incredibly grateful and overwhelmed by the reception that Riot Baby has received. It really is, beyond my wildest imaginings. And so, I'm just blessed.
And you've had a very busy year this year as well. I mean, you had a nonfiction book come out, Skinfolk. And then, of course, I say this year because we're recording in 2021. I have to remember that this is airing in 2022. So really, last year, you had a busy year. And this year, 2022 is starting off busy as well because Goliath comes out.
Yes, January 25th, the big day.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I hope you don't feel I in any way shortchanged Goliath in the opening, because it's really about so much more than just gentrification. But that, I think, is just one of the key prisms that struck me. And it's one of the prisms through which you tell the story. But since there is a lot going on, there are a lot of characters and a lot of stories, I was curious to hear how you describe the book to people.
Oh, my goodness. Well, my general elevator pitch is that Goliath is the story of a group of black and brown brick stackers in a post-apocalyptic post-climate event, New Haven, Connecticut, that have to deal with gentrifiers from space. So I think you hit the nail on the head.
Ah, okay, good, good. All right. Well, so I kind of want to talk about the general feeling that the book conveys. I think, you know, when we spoke last year, it wasn't long after George Floyd's murder. And in this book, there is an oblique reference to it. I mean, there is a reference to it without naming him. So it's kind of an important historic turning point. And last year in the real world, in real life, it felt, I think, somewhat like it was a potentially positive turning point. I mean, there were so many murders of black and brown people by cops and vigilantes, like with Ahmaud Arbery, for instance. But this feeling that it set in motion a meaningful, hopefully meaningful reckoning with positive changes. But in Goliath, you are showing us a future, I think a few decades in the future, where those, you know, looking back on the events of today, they really mark a beginning of a turn for the worse. And there are privileged people who I think are mostly white, and they're living in these, they call them colonies, but they're space stations. And people who are on Earth, those who are left behind, couldn't afford to go, you know, they have to wear masks because the air is so polluted. There's radiation everywhere. There's a white supremacist nation out west. And if you have money, I guess, or the gentrifiers, they can live under a dome. That's what they're doing. So they're sort of blocking out the world. So it's a dark future building on what feels like the facts of recent history. So I guess I want to just talk generally about that. And is this your prediction, your gut feeling about where things are going? Is it a cautionary tale, like we don't have to go there? So take it away.
It's funny. I've been thinking quite a bit recently about the idea of science fiction as a genre serving this social utility of prediction, right? We present these dystopian futures to say, don't do this. Don't name your company this, most certainly. Don't develop this X technology. And inevitably, you know, we see the William Gibson novels start to come true. And so I don't know necessarily that science fiction novels can be any sort of handbook for how to you know, fight the forces of evil, so to speak, whatever form they may take. I think at the end of the day, science fiction and speculative fiction in general is all about our now, is all about our present. You know, no matter how far flung into the future or how deep into the past or adjacent to our past a story may be set, it's always saying something about the time in which it was written. And I think what's interesting about setting a story like Goliath in, you know, the 2050s is that it's very much about now. And what's funny, so I started writing Goliath, or at least the short story that ultimately became Goliath, was written in 2013, and then I started sort of building it into a novel probably around like 2015. And even in that draft, people were wearing masks, they were dealing with air quality issues, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, 2020 happens, at which point I'd sold the book, and people are walking around in masks, and there's, you know, people are dealing with air pollution and so many of the things that had happened in the book were starting to become reality for a lot of people. But really, Goliath is just, in many ways, about our now. I think what science fiction does allow us to do is it allows us to, you know, through the mechanism of thought experiments, push a certain social dynamic past its breaking point. I could look at, say, for instance, the ways in which white supremacist organizations and militias organize themselves in the United States and the ways in which they have flourished over the past, you know, half decade, certainly. And I can extrapolate, okay, what might this look like if things turn for the worse? You know, if we see, for instance, the ways in which individuals or organizations can be emboldened to, you know, launch an attack on the Capitol building to prevent, you know, the results of a presidential election being announced, what is it going to look like in the future when, you know, the social fabric is that much more frayed, you know, that sort of thing. So much of the environmental issues that are raised in the book are things that are happening, you know, say, for instance, in India. One of the really big lodestones for me, inspirationally for the book, was the writings of Arundhati Roy, who, in addition to writing The God of Small Things, is also like a huge and hugely important and involved environmentalist, and has all this incredible nonfiction that she's written about the social costs of the, you know, the various projects that the government has embarked upon, you know, the ways in which entities like the World Bank are financially tied into the like environmental and economic oppression of lower classes in society. It's astounding, right? And so much of that made its way into Goliath as well, and that stuff's happening now. Gentrification, you know, it's happening now. You know, the ways in which, you know, or I guess you could say the cycle sometimes that cities and neighborhoods go through, where they'll be inhabited by a certain class of people, but then they'll be drained of resources, you know, and you see it in, you know, for instance, the ways in which we use property tax to fund schools, right? They'll be drained of resources, desiccated, people will lose their homes, and then all of a sudden, these things become attractive to a new sort of higher class in the social strata who, you know, move in and start to make the thing their own. And like, again, all of that is happening now, but you know, I throw some sort of mutated beasts into the mix, and I put some neighborhoods in space, and all of a sudden it's science fiction. And I feel like, I hope that if there is a sort of utility to science fiction, it's that it allows us, or perhaps pushes us, to look at our now and see, okay, what's going on? It's diagnosis as opposed to a blueprint for a cure, if that makes any sense.
No, that does make sense. And so what are you telling us about our now? And maybe we could look at, you know, specifically some of the characters in the book. So when we're talking about gentrifiers, I think they're embodied in this couple, David and Jonathan, and they're returning from... It's funny, I have to say, it's funny they're called the colonies, but really, I mean, they're living in this new space station. It's like virgin territory. It's not really a colony. And yet when they return to Earth, that's when it looks like they're mm-hmm. colonizers. You know, they're coming back to Earth, or where they, or their parents lived. I can't remember now. I think they came as children too, to the space stations. So really they become colonizers, it seems, when they're coming back. But what's going on for them? I mean, my sense is they're a little bored. It's like too nice, you know? Mm-hmm. So what's your sense? Can you tell us about what's driving them?
So they were, for me, a vessel through which I could like sort of critique and at the same time dramatize frontier narratives. You know, I've read a lot of Westerns and sort of Western-inflected literature, you know, over the course of my life and my career as a writer, and the ways in which people have written about the American West were very sort of fundamental in how I approached the characters of David and Jonathan. You know, in some instances, you know, you have people going out west historically for all sorts of reasons. Oh, that's where my fortune is, and maybe they come from sort of straitened circumstances. They've fallen on hard times back in the East, and they're like, oh, like there are no rules out there. I can totally remake myself. You know, they're on the run from the law, maybe. Or, you know, they're trying to fix their broken relationship, and they think, oh, if we just change the scenery, that'll make things better. We'll be able to start over. And so there's this idea in Jonathan that, you know, things aren't working out between me and David. It's the environment that's the problem. We can make this work on Earth. You know, we just need to, you know, it's new, it's virgin territory. It's this place where we can build something together. And that in many ways is the animating impulse. Of course, completely or almost completely disregarding the fact that Earth is already home to a lot of people. And this whole idea of displacement and like, and they even joke about it too, in that they recognize even as they participate in them, they recognize the frontier narratives that they're trying to sort of disparage or trying to be better than. Like, we're not going to be like, you know, we're not going to be like, we're going to be like the first wave of pilgrims, not the ones with the smallpox blanket. You know, it's like that sort of thing. And so that, I think, is, you know, there's no more sort of American West the way that it used to be talked about. But I think a lot of that same dynamic, and a lot of the dynamic that I think fueled colonial, you know, projects is at work there. Whenever there's a sort of gentrification, whenever people, I think, from a higher sort of caste, so to speak, decide to displace themselves willingly to go somewhere else where there are already people, I think oftentimes what animates that is this impulse to fix something internally or to address something internally. Maybe there's wanderlust. Maybe, you know, they're trying to escape something emotionally or spiritually, or maybe they believe the thing that they're looking for, capital T thing, is in this new place. So that's some of what is going on with David and Jonathan. And also, you know, I wanted to really write into a lot of the subtext of the biblical relationship between the biblical, you know, David, eventual King David, and Jonathan. There, in many ways, these two characters are sort of positioned as the Israelites versus the Philistines. And one of the questions that sort of served as an impellent for this story was, okay, what were the Philistines up to before they started beefing with the Israelites? And, you know, before that conflict, before that clash, before the David and Goliath story, we don't really hear about the Philistines. We don't really know what's going on with them, what their society's like. You know, is it patriarchal, matriarchal? What's their, you know, what religion, et cetera, et cetera. We just learn of them in the context of their clash and eventual loss to the Israelites. And that very much interested me. And that, I think, is a dynamic that we see replicated in gentrification narratives. Oftentimes, and not just fiction, but particularly reportage about gentrification, there's never really any follow-up on the people who get pushed out. You know, there's talk of that clash, and then people leave, but we don't find out where they go. You know, where do they get pushed to? Where do they disperse to? And that was something that I wanted to explore in Goliath. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, it's interesting. I mean, you're tying together a lot of threads, and I mean, it just speaks to the complexity of the book. There's a lot. You can read it on many different levels. I want to ask, I mean, there are just so many characters, so it's like we could just jump around, but I was intrigued by many of them. I was particularly intrigued by the stories around Sydney, a young woman. We meet her initially in New Haven, but then we flash back to her, more of her origin. And she has such an interesting origin. She's in the desert with her father, and he's harvesting or collecting cacti in the desert. Yeah. And he's live streaming the collection to collect bids from I call them colonists, that's what they call themselves, but the dudes in space, you know. And it's like, how much for this? And it's this weird mix of performance and entrepreneurialism and almost like circus performing kind of thing, but very dangerous what he's doing. But you don't, you know, the people doing the bidding are just bidding on the baubles as far as these exotic, rare cacti. So anyway, it's an interesting beginning, interesting story. So I want to ask about her. And then, you know, later she has another interesting turn. We could talk about both those things, I think. So what's going on with her in the beginning? Like who is Sydney?
Oh, man. So she's one of my favorite characters, in part because, you know, even still, she's so much of an enigma to me. And that is such a fascinating, I don't even want to call it dilemma as a writer. It's something I actually take quite a bit of pleasure in, trying to figure out what's going on, what the machinery is inside of a character that I'm writing. And, you know, sometimes I'll be forced to sort of write around that. What are their circumstances? How did they grow up? Et cetera, et cetera. What animates them? What pushes them? What do they want? And so building out Sydney's story was like really fun. I mean, it's incredibly tragic, but like that, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, because that's pretty much backstory of like everybody in this book. But it was this wonderful opportunity to explore another part of the country sort of during this period. You know, the vast majority of the action in the book is set in New Haven, but these characters and their rich histories gave me this incredible canvas wherein I can make this not just a story about urban decay and urban renewal and all the ways in which that, you know, accumulates flesh and blood and bone, but the story of America sort of writ large in this time and place. And so, yeah, so there's an aspect of it that's funny. Like, there's humor in that her dad is like selling these cacti to people in space. And he does, as you pointed out, there's this whole performance. He's sort of like an auctioneer. And, you know, there's even a point where he's getting one over on the buyers, because like he'll be like, oh, this one's really, really, really rare. I got a lot of people lined up for this one. Like, da, da, da. And then Sydney in her head is like, no, there are like 50 million of those like in the desert in front of us right now. So I also wanted to show some of what it can look like when you are forced to sort of pillage your own resources. And so there's this dynamic where I know there's a lot of reporting on it right now, the coltan mines in the DRC, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And one of the reasons there's a lot of reportage about that right now is because the U.S. just let a lot of their sort of mining concerns being a financial sort of term of art, lapse. And China is swooping in and gobbling up all these sort of coltan deposits. And one of the reasons that coltan is so important is because it's in basically every electronic device in your house, cell phone, laptop, all of that. It's one of the most valuable metals in the entire world. And oftentimes it occurs alongside copper, it's all this stuff. But the miners themselves, the artisanal miners, the people that are like doing the digging and all that stuff, are local Congolese who don't really see any of the massive profits that the extraction of this resource gives them. But oftentimes you can see in situations like that and analogous situations, you know, all these sorts of entrepreneurial side alleys, right? Because you'll see communities like mining communities build up, and then you have people that need to sell, you know, whatever's locally occurring to them to these buyers who have varying levels of awareness of whether or not they're getting taken for a ride. But that was a thing that I wanted to sort of show as well, where it's like, this is what we have to do to survive. And it's not like, oh, I feel all this terrible guilt at taking this resource, you know, these beautiful things off of the land. No, it's like, this is like, I'm making a buck. Like, I'm trying to make a buck. I'm trying to feed my daughter. And so I know I've been talking a lot about Sydney's dad, but one of the reasons for that is that Sydney's dad looms very much in her life, his presence, but also his absence. And that was another thing that I wanted to play with regards to these characters, the way in which familial absence colors their lives, the ways in which it influences who they talk to, what they talk about, how they talk about it with people. You know, do they try to find replacements for these various figures, or do they walk around with this mom-sized ache, this father-sized ache, this brother-sized ache constantly? And so that, like, Sydney was such an incredible character to write through and to write around. And in many ways, she provides a sort of through line for a lot of the emotional undercurrents of the book. But yeah, but also too, like she and her dad and her younger sister live on the Texas-Mexico border. And there's like this, you know, they have this crew of like Mexican smugglers that they're just like chilling with. And I was very fortunate in that I was able to find a lot of humor in Sydney's scenes, and humor that occurred naturally, just sort of humor as a natural resource in these scenes, because it is, you know, it's an emotionally heavy book. And in a way that I sometimes see as a contrast to Riot Baby. Riot Baby is very condensed. It's very sort of concentrated. Claustrophobia was kind of the point. And it's very much pitched at this almost incandescently angry register for like a lot of the book, to the extent that I knew I couldn't really go past like 176 pages with that book because that was just emotionally unsustainable. Goliath gave me a larger sort of emotional canvas to play with, and I could do a lot of different registers emotionally. And so scenes like Sydney's allowed me to oscillate between those registers and to really play with tone in very interesting ways. And so, yeah, no, I love Sydney. I love Sydney so much. Yeah.
Would you mind talking just a little bit more about her? Because it's very intriguing that she later in the book comes upon these horses, which I guess are, I was never sure if they're actually wild horses or they had been domestic horses that are just wandering around. So, but anyway, there are these horses that seem to have no particular home other than nature. And she returns to the site and brings them back to New Haven and creates a barn, a stable. And they become a source of kind of wonder and fascination for everyone. You know, I mean, it's sort of an anomaly almost. What are these horses doing here? So it feels like both an adventure and, just kind of a kind of surprising plot twist, but also fraught with symbolism, I think. And I just wonder what if you could just talk about that, what that means to Sydney or what the horses mean to the story.
Yeah, no, another dynamic with Sydney is that she's very connected to the natural environment. She's very attuned to things. So, you know, it's important that it's her that initially finds the horses. And even when she first brings Tamika, another stacker, Tamika's like, how did you know this was here? You know, and Sydney, for reasons that are, you know, revealed in the book, is not much of a talker. And oftentimes when you don't sort of communicate in a way that a lot of people see as sort of typical, you find other things to sort of connect with. And so that was one of the, like, she like listens to trees and bugs, and like she's very attuned. Like her dad, like, you know, picks cacti, and she, you know, just for survival had to know the different sounds her footfalls would make on sand and on desert ground, because not knowing could result in a very violent end. And so, like, yeah, she's sort of the leader of the crew that pulls off the heist, so to speak, you know, which was a really fun element to throw into the book. And, you know, I really wanted to ram home this idea of the sort of incongruity of the horses in this environment, but also show that, like, you know, a lot of this place is sort of grown over, right? Like, it's not maintained. The roads are very, you know, it's very sort of The Last of Us in certain respects. But, you know, these horses, which are like a naturally occurring thing in nature, feel otherworldly here, even though here is also still nature now because of the horrible things that, like, mankind did and then left. Yeah, so there's all that stuff swirling around. And so I was very fortunate to have in Sydney a character who, you know, could provide that connection, because it was very important to be able to show how the characters related to the natural environment and not just the city that they live in.
Were there any other characters you wanted to talk about? Who is the most difficult for you to write?
It's funny, Allison. And it's funny because there's a lot of her in the book, you know. But it's like, it's funny. I'm surrounded by well-meaning white allies in my, you know, for and have been for so long. But trying to capture that voice, it's like, and in a way that doesn't caricature her, right? Trying to capture that voice and put it in a sort of full-bodied person and not have them come across as a stereotype. That, I think, might have been the most difficult thing to finesse, because it's a very, I think, delicate balance to strike, where you want to show the thing that you're critiquing and you want to be able to critique it, but at the same time, you don't want a reader to not care about a character and to not care about what a character has to say. And so I needed to make all of that work.
And she's a reporter, right? She's come in to like describe the work that they're doing, give it, you try to humanize her. I don't know. I don't remember who she's writing for, actually. Who's the audience?
Oh, it's a number. It's what was funny about her pieces, and you know, to those who have or who will read the book who weren't sure, you know, she is the author of all of the reported pieces in the book. You know, it's a variety of publications that I kind of tried to mimic there, and that format-wise, it was interesting to try to sort of mimic. You know, there's an Esquire piece. There's a, you know, a short piece that, you know, could see a home in the London Review of Books. There's a, you know, I don't know, a piece that might have a home in the Virginia Quarterly Review. Like, so the people who read those magazines, those publications, the people who read articles in those places, they're her sort of audience. And oftentimes it can sort of zero in on this sort of this urbane, upper middle class, usually white demographic, right? You know, with various sort of skews to the left or right with regards to the publication. But yeah, like that, as difficult as she was to write, those pieces were a lot of fun because I like read all of those publications. And so I wouldn't have necessarily felt comfortable trying to capture their tone or do a pastiche of their tone had I not read as much of them as I do. So it was a lot of fun. Like, I don't know that there were any characters I shied away from writing or that were difficult in a way that made me not want to write about them or that made writing their scenes difficult. They were all challenging. All of them presented their own challenges, but they were all challenges that I was eager to engage in as a writer.
And it took many years, it sounds like. You started, I mean, this has been in the works a while, and it's, I mean, I can understand why, too, because it's a complex story with a lot of interwoven characters and places and even some time jumps and things. Mm-hmm. So I imagine it was, well, I don't know if there's any insight you can offer just into the process of creating the book.
Oh man, it went through a lot of iterations. It's funny, Goliath is fundamentally different from everything else that I've written because it is the first and so far only piece of long fiction that I've written out of order. This isn't to say that I'm a consummate planner, but I generally know what's going to happen before it happens in the story to varying extents. You know, sometimes I have or all I have is a one-page synopsis. Other times I will have scene-by-scene breakdowns of each chapter, whatever a chapter might look like in a particular book. But this book, the short story that spawned it, is a series of scenes that occur in the sort of first section, but a ways into the first section. And then I started writing some of the scenes that appear in fall, but like out of order. And then, you know, I went back to the section that's called summer, and then I hopped over to spring, and I think winter, because the book, you know, sort of ostensibly takes place over the course of a year, or the present day, quote unquote present day action takes place over the course of a year, and the section called winter, I think, was the last section of new material that I wrote for the book, and I don't know that winter existed when I sold the book. It certainly didn't exist in the earlier, you know, iterations of the book. I mean, this is probably the draft that's circulating now in these arcs is probably, I'd say, draft number five or six, somewhere around there. And yeah, there were large chunks of the book that didn't exist in between those drafts. And so it was an absolutely terrifying process, like not necessarily knowing what exactly was going to happen when, but thrilling at the same time. It really felt like writing this book, I was pushing myself to the edges of my abilities as the writer that I was at the time that I wrote this book. And whew, it was a roller coaster.
What's next for you? What are you working on now? What's on the horizon for 2022?
Oh man, I'm eager to let Goliath breathe a little bit. I don't know that I have anything on the horizon, or at least anything that I can talk about publicly that, you know, I'm not buried under, you know, a Mount Rushmore of NDAs about right now. But one thing that is sort of ongoing, I'm very lucky to be doing a mini series for Marvel Comics. It's a Black Panther Legends. It's targeted at young readers as a retelling of the origins of Black Panther, focusing on the childhood of a young T'Challa. It is and has been such an extraordinary thing to write, so much fun, but also super meaningful. I mean, Marvel, you know, for me, in my experience, has been a dream workplace. I've had an incredible editor there. And you know, so there's that. I'm trying to think, is there anything else? Probably got some short stories with my name on them, like, you know, floating somewhere out there in the ether. But like, I'd say Goliath is like the big thing.
Wonderful. Well, it's a great story. Thank you so much for coming back on New Books in Science Fiction.
Thank you for having me. Again, such a pleasure.
I have been speaking with Tochi Onyebuchi about Goliath from Tor.com. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to the podcast if you aren't already a subscriber. And please think about giving the show 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. Michael Aaron of QuiverNYC.com composed our theme music. I'm Rob Wolf, and I edit the show. Marshall Poe is editor and founder of the New Books Network, and Leanne Wilson is the co-editor. Be well and keep reading.
Thank you.